This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, November 18th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. In an interview on Sunday with Donald Trump on 60 Minutes, Leslie Stahl asked him about acts of violence that are popping up in his name against members of minority groups.
I'm very surprised to hear that. I hate to hear that. I mean, I hate
but
to hear
But you do
that.
Hear it.
I don't hear it.
I saw one or two instances. On social media?
But I think
media?
It's a very small amount. Again, I think it's
do
the media.
Do you want to say anything to those people?
I would say don't do it. That's terrible. Because I'm going to bring this country together.
They're harassing Latinos, Muslims.
I am so saddened to hear that. And I say stop it. If it helps, I will say this, and I'll say it right to the camera, stop it.
I'm joined by Matt Lewis and Kella Fasana to discuss how the Republican Party will govern under the Trump administration. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Matt, you describe yourself as a populist, but you deplored Trump's politics of nativism, racism, victimhood, you name it. Were you surprised by the results?
Yeah, so I'm a populist if populism means having trust in average Americans as opposed to big governmental bureaucracies or, you know, fat cats or elitists. But I'm against the kind of populism that pits us against each other. And so that kind of nativism, George Wallace populism, I actually hate. I was surprised by the results. I thought Hillary Clinton would win narrowly. I think I gave her 274 electoral votes when I did my little map on 270towin.com. So I thought Donald Trump would do a lot better than most people. I had him winning Florida and North Carolina and New Hampshire and Iowa. I just didn't quite think he could overcome, say, like the Democratic machine in Philadelphia. So, I think a lot of us were surprised Tuesday night.
And what about you, Kay?
I mean, I was certainly surprised. I think there's been a lot of talk about this idea that, you know, people in the coasts didn't get how much anger there was in the middle of the country, et cetera. I dissent slightly from that just because I think at the end of the day, it's hard to – we don't really have any good alternative to polling, right? And so if you have just about every poll shows one candidate has a lead – I think it's natural that people are going to assume that that candidate is more likely to win. So I say that just to say that I think that a lot of the surprise in places like New York about Trump's victory, you know, really had a lot to do with polling numbers. Although obviously there was shock because there had been, you know, conventional wisdom going back to the primaries that Donald Trump wouldn't be successful. But I'm wondering, Matt, you're what's known as a never Trump conservative. When you start realizing that, whoa, Trump is really going to win this, was your visceral reaction a certain amount of joy, or was your visceral reaction dread?
A little bit of both, I would say. On one hand, I am, you know, an opinion journalist, and I live in Northern Virginia, and I work in D.C. On the other hand, I'm from Western Maryland. My dad was a prison guard for about 30 years in Hagerstown, Maryland. My mom actually lives in Pennsylvania and was a Trump voter. So I know a lot of Trump people, a lot of Trump voters, a lot of my family voted for Trump. And so I understand where they're coming from, probably in a way that some of my colleagues do not fully appreciate. I opposed Trump in the primary, and in the general election, I could not in good conscience support either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. But having said that, my attitude has been that once Donald Trump became our president-elect, I was going to try to be as optimistic as I possibly could. I'm still going to call him out when I think he's wrong. But for the last two or three weeks, with the exception of a couple of ill-advised tweets, Donald Trump has actually behaved himself fairly well. And I think the comments that we talked about earlier, where he was on 60 Minutes and condemned violence, is part of it. I would also give credit to others, including Hillary Clinton and President Obama, for being very responsible during this time where, you know, the transition of power is very important, the peaceful transition of power. But I think Donald Trump, to his credit, has rhetorically conducted himself quite well in the last few weeks.
What about some of the appointments that are going forward? Maybe start with Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama for Attorney General.
So, I would start by talking about balance. I balance that with picks like Mike Pence, who I think is thought of as sort of a mainstream conservative, Reince Priebus, the chief of staff, a respected establishment Republican. Then you've got other people like Steve Bannon, a senior advisor that has been very controversial. Jeff Sessions would not be my pick for attorney general, but I think he is certainly qualified. I think he will be confirmed by the United States Senate. And I would say elections have consequences. You know, Jeff Sessions was a loyalist, very loyal, very early supporter of Donald Trump. And, you know, a lot of people are now all of a sudden coming to their senses and shocked that Donald Trump would pick some of these people. And like, I dealt with this grieving process months ago when I opposed his candidacy. And now I think it's par for the course.
What about Michael Flynn for National Security Advisor?
Another guy that I think is eminently qualified. Generally speaking, I think that presidents deserve the right to get to select their advisors. I think Flynn, unfortunately, in the last year, since becoming a Trump supporter, has tweeted things that are unfortunate and controversial. But I think if you look at the totality of his experience, he certainly is qualified to advise the president on national security matters.
It's amazing how much of the what is purported to be evidence against Trump comes from Twitter.
Yes.
In matters of Trump as elsewhere, it often is hard to tell whether the benefits of tweeting outweigh the drawbacks. I think that one question is that so much of the criticism of Trump has to do with temperament, both his temperament and the temperament of some of the people that surround him, and experience. And, you know, there's good reason to have those critiques, but it kind of leaves open this question, which I think we're all trying to figure out, of the extent to which the ideas and the governing philosophy guiding Trump are actually different from, you know, the mainstream among conservatives, the mainstream among Republicans. And part of that is that it's sometimes hard to figure out which of these various things he cares about. You know, he spends over a year claiming falsely, as far as we can tell, that he was against the Iraq War at the time, although it's I have no reason to disbelieve that he is against the Iraq War now. And then it's time to staff the government, and you see some people that are in favor of the Iraq War that he wants to bring in. And so that makes me wonder, well, to what extent is that actually an animating issue for him? To what extent does he want a different foreign policy from George W. Bush's foreign policy?
And to what extent has he thought these issues through? He doesn't seem to be terribly well-versed in foreign policy, among other things.
I do think that personnel is policy, and bureaucrats and cabinet members, to some degree, implement things. And so having Ambassador Bolton is different than having, you know, Mike Flynn is different from having Newt Gingrich. I mean, you know,
tell us why.
Well, I think that they have different foreign policy worldviews. And I do think you have a point that Donald Trump, I think when it comes to issues, say, like trade, at least in recent years, he's been very consistent as kind of a populist protectionist. But when it comes to foreign policy, I think he's somewhat schizophrenic and incoherent. And so I think that if he picks somebody who is thought of as a neocon or a hawk, that's going to be very different than if he picks somebody who wants a more humble foreign policy. So I think to some degree, you know, the knock on Donald Trump has been whoever the last person who whispers in his ear is, that's the direction he goes. So that's why I think that staffing and appointments do matter.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
David Remnick has a piece in the upcoming issue about President Obama's reaction to the Trump victory. And among many other interesting things Obama told him is that he doesn't believe that Republicans care about inequality. He said there's no pretense that anything they're putting forward, any congressional proposals that are going forward, will reduce inequality. Is he wrong?
Well, I think he's wrong, but I think it's I think it's much more complex than that. I think that there are a menu of values that all Americans, all humans care about. I mean, I've got two little kids. Trust me, it is hardwired in us to care about inequality. But I think that we pit different values against different values. And so conservatives care maybe more about equal opportunity than equal outcome. And I think it's a bit simplistic to say that conservatives don't care about equality, but I do think that it's in competition with other values that make it, a little more nuanced than that.
You know, again, it's hard to figure out how much these things have changed, right? I mean, I think at the time of the Obama-Romney campaign, it was fashionable to say, oh, this is a terrible campaign, this is very negative, et cetera. Looking back, Obama versus Romney was really largely idea-driven. I mean, these were people arguing about two different economic philosophies. And so someone like Romney had a fairly clear view that the economy was not a zero-sum game, that helping poor people didn't mean making rich people less rich and that you could grow the pie. And you know, these were fairly traditional Republican economic ideas. With Trump, you've seen the glimmers of a more populist, less free market approach in his campaign. And the question is whether that, you know, goes on into him governing.
It also occurs to me that I think that conservatives and liberals have different worldviews, and sometimes we say these words, but we mean different things when we say them. So I think you could have a real debate over, for example, what does fairness mean? A liberal might say that fairness means everybody gets the same amount of money, of resources, or whatever. A conservative might say, no. Fairness means if I work more hours, I get more money. Or if I work harder, I get more money. And so you could, both sides may very well argue that they're in favor of equality or fairness, but that means very different things depending on your worldview.
But Matt, this also raises questions about specifics and how the country will go forward on particular legislation. So it has been really interesting this past week to listen to Bernie Sanders say that he will work with Donald Trump on infrastructure.
I don't know. I mean, he very well could get off to a really good start. I think that you could see a bipartisan bill on infrastructure that would be very popular with the American public and would be a sign of actually things getting done. We've had so much gridlock, which, look, I think the founding fathers created a system that invites gridlock, like, on purpose. But having said that, I think it's unpopular. And then, you know, I think Donald Trump's going to get a Supreme Court pick right away. That will be very popular, probably with his base. So I think we may look back at the first 100 days and be astonished, you know, at how well things at least get off to a good start.
And I'm really curious to get your response, Matt, to something that Obama said yesterday in Germany in a joint press conference with Angela Merkel.
If we are not serious about facts and what's true and what's not. And particularly in an age of social media where so many people are getting their information in sound bites and snippets off their phones, if we can't discriminate between serious arguments and propaganda, then we have problems.
So, Matt, you share that concern. I know that from what you've written and what you've been saying.
Fewer sound bites, more podcasts.
Exactly. No podcasts. How influential in the election were Breitbart and the fake news, which is now a huge issue, the fake news that's been shared on Facebook?
Incredibly. And I do have to say I'm biased toward podcasts. Twitter leads to propaganda and to misunderstandings and to fights and and long form conversations lead to understanding. Look, I'm sort of in this weird spot because, you know, if it wasn't for Twitter, I don't think I would be here today. If it wasn't for the new media, like podcasts and blogging and Twitter, you know, I wouldn't have a voice as whatever I am. But I also think that when you lower the barrier of entry, then you also, not only do you let in people like me, but you let in barbarians at the gates, some of whom do not have, you know, the best motives.
But remember that Trump is mediagenic across a wide variety of platforms, right? Like, Trump is great TV just as he is great Twitter content, just as he is great Facebook content, right? So it I'm not sure it makes sense to necessarily, you know, quote unquote, blame or credit one or the other. I mean, he is.
But if it wasn't for 24-hour cable news and if it wasn't for Twitter, do you think Donald Trump could have won the Republican primary?
Absolutely not.
No, but the rise of those things and the decline of kind of old school media gatekeepers goes in parallel with the decline of old school political gatekeepers and the declining power of political parties, right? So a general distrust of all those kinds of authorities, a general skepticism about the nature of experts and authorities is related to all these things. And I just want to say on the record, I love this media environment. I think it's way better than what we've had before. I as someone who consumes a lot of this stuff, I think it's great. I want to ask you, switching to a very old kind of media, Matt, as a fan of yours, someone who read your book, Too Dumb to Fail, the timing behind that book went from seeming like sort of bad to incredibly good to who the heck knows. And I'm wondering, how wrong were you? Obviously, you were wrong in the sense that in this presumption that the Republicans aren't going to be able to succeed in the short term unless they moderate and, you know, become pro-immigration and all these other things. But what about the longer term? I mean, is it possible that the longer path for success for the Republicans, for the conservative movement, runs through Trump?
So I think if Trump had lost, there would have been a fight over the heart and soul of the Republican Party. And it's possible that Trumpism would have been delegitimized and you could have moved to a kinder, gentler form of conservatism in the vein of a Ronald Reagan, Jack Kemp. But I think that it is now the party of Donald Trump. I've always argued in the short term that could be a rational thing to do. It may now be that in the near future, Republicans basically win Ohio and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. I think the problem with that is you could also envision losing Arizona, the Sun Belt, maybe even eventually Texas. So I am still very concerned. I think that in the short term, Republicans basically control everything right now. It really worked out better than anybody could have possibly imagined. I still have long-term demographic concerns, and I think that this may in the long run turn out very badly for the Republican Party.
Are you among those who criticize the electoral system we have? Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote, and Republicans have not done well historically on winning the popular vote. Is this a crazy, antiquated system that we have?
No, I like the Electoral College. I'm sort of biased toward our founding fathers' vision. I think it's a mistake for Democrats to sort of dismiss their problems by saying, hey, we won the popular vote. By the same token, you know, while I support the Electoral College, I think it would be a mistake for Republicans to dismiss the fact that they have now lost, what is it, the popular vote in 6 out of the last 7 presidential elections. They need to take that very seriously. And look, if Republicans lose Texas, I mean, if we get to a world where the Democrats start off with a map that has California, New York, and Texas penciled in, I think it's game over. And that's a concern. That's something that I think Republicans have to be very, you know, cautious about.
Oh, I mean, I think one thing about politics is that we have a tendency to overdetermine the results, especially when the result is close to a tie. I mean, this is true in sports too, right? The World Series goes down to Game 7 and it's a comeback. And essentially, statistically speaking, the World Series was a tie. But in fact, we remember one team as being relatively dominant and one team just couldn't get it done. But I think it's sometimes useful to remember that each of these parties attracts – sort of roughly kind of more or less half of the vote. And these small nudges up and down make a huge difference to our lives and to who's governing. But it's not as the country is 60-40 or 70-30. And so so sometimes these unpredictable events, the personal qualities of one candidate or another, these small strategic things can make a difference.
Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Khalifa Sana is a New Yorker staff writer. Matt Lewis is a writer for The Daily Caller and the author of Too Dumb to Fail, How the GOP Went from the Party of Reagan to the Party of Trump. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com or on the New Yorker apps, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. And you can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The Political Scene is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Duboff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.